You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's time once again for another episode, episode 31 of Health and the Awakening of the Self. Health, my name is Dr. Mike, and I'm a medical doctor and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation. And we try to bring you pertinent information to help you preserve and restore your health. And the other side of the show is the awakening of the self. By the self, we mean the one with the capital S. There's also a small self. This is the one that Buddha referred to when he said that the self is non-existent. It doesn't really exist. It's just mocked up by the mind, by the projections and the thoughts and the memory and other things. And we assume it's real. But once we start to transcend the small self, our attachments, we find out that we're really the universal self, the larger expanded self. And when we come in touch with that particular self, we start to notice that we're more harmonious, we're more free inside, because we're free from the pressure of the psychological mind and the negative thought that goes on sometimes in the mind. And we're also more peaceful, more creative, and we have more compassion for our fellow man. So these are very worthwhile experiences that enable us to activate and realize our full potential, our full, secure self. The small self is actually based on fear and the fact that it needs more to feel fulfilled, that it's not fulfilled, whereas the big self is living in the moment, it's fulfilled, it has the feeling and the experience of fulfillment, and it's secure. That's why when you take and do these exercises, you become more and more secure by degrees. You can call into this show at any time during the show, and you can interrupt whatever's going on. We don't mind. The number is 831-427-3772. I'll repeat that again in a minute, so grab a pencil so you have time to write that down. The email we have here is frsc@freakradio. That's all one word, freakradio.org. If you have a spiritual master you'd like to hear on this show, please contact me and we'll see about putting him on. We do have a slogan on this show, and the slogan is, may the mind fall into the heart. May the mind get dissolved in the heart, dissolved in the state of beingness, the state of awake presence that we really are. You know, one other thing is, you can't really realize yourself or the truth by reading a book or by listening to a radio. But if you follow the directions, the actual specific exercises that we give out, these allow you to access and to experience the deeper, more subtle levels of consciousness. And also, if you follow the guided meditation, that will help you to access the experience of truth and freedom within yourself. All right, so that music at the beginning was Joss Groban, and he'll be our guest tonight on this show for most of the show. We'll also try to introduce some other singers. But he's quite a good singer, well-known singer in his own right. So I think he's a good choice. All right, we're just setting up here. Over the years I read some of Suzanne Somers is a fairly well-known movie Hollywood star, but she had some experiences with cancer, and she's written some books on different things. And her books are interviews with the more progressive doctors around the United States and some other countries. And I thought she did a very good job. I have a healthy respect for her books. And if you happen to find any of her books, I do recommend that you read them, because she's quite liberal and quite insightful. And we're going to set her up here now. She's been interviewed on one of the television stations, and we're just queuing it up right now. It should be coming out. There we go.
Welcome to Newsmax TV. I'm Kathleen Walter. She is one of America's most popular and beloved personalities, who has achieved success as an actress, a best-selling author, entrepreneur, and comedian. Suzanne Somers has authored 18 books, including 8 New York Times bestsellers. A dedicated healthcare advocate recognized for her role in bringing information on today's groundbreaking anti-aging medical protocols, preventive care, and long-term health to the public, Suzanne joins us to talk about her newest book, Knockout, interviews with doctors who are curing cancer and how to prevent getting it in the first place. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Nice to be here.
You've written a number of self-help books and have had a positive impact on so many lives as a result. Talk to us about why you wrote Knockout.
I wrote Knockout because I was diagnosed with cancer 10 years ago, correctly, and I am cancer-free. But earlier this year, I was misdiagnosed with lung cancer that metastasized throughout my entire body. In fact, my oncologist said, I have never seen so much cancer. And he said, what we can do is we can start you on full body chemotherapy today. And I looked at him and I said, just so you know where I'm coming from, I'd rather die. I would never take chemical poisoning. It's just not in my nature to do something like that. He said, well, then I think you should think about getting your things in order. And this was reconfirmed over 6 days in the hospital by 6 different doctors, all telling me that it was inoperable, incurable, and essentially hopeless. What I did hold on to, around day 3 or 4, I said to my husband, you know, I've been keeping a file on these doctors who are curing cancer, in most cases without drugs. If I can get out of this hospital, I want you to take me to one of them. So on the 6th day, when it turned out that they were horribly wrong, I was misdiagnosed, it was wrong, I had no cancer at all after looking death in the eye for 6 days, I thought, rather than get mad, I'm going to interview these doctors in this file. And that's what I've done for the better part of this year, is talk to these doctors, interview them, and I would say to each of them, it's all well and good for you to tell me this, I need to talk to your patients. They opened up their patients to me. I talked to stage 4 lung cancer, liver cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, brain tumors. All these people living these normal, healthy lives, having not been degraded by harsh chemicals, and I realized there is another way that none of us know about. And so that's what I've written about in Knockout. Other options that you probably don't know anything about.
Now, you interview doctors and medical professionals using everything from alternative to integrative to conventional methods to combat cancer.
Right.
Among them was NewsmaxHealth.com contributor Dr. Blaylock, who you also interviewed for your book, Breakthrough. Mm-hmm. Tell
Love
us why
him.
You revisited Dr. Blaylock and what insights did you feel that he would offer?
Well, Dr. Blaylock is one of the brightest minds in the country. He's an oncologist, neurosurgeon for 22 years, stopped surgery because he said he was opening brain, seeing cancer so rare in younger and younger people that he decided he had to devote the rest of his life to research to the effects of chemicals on the human brain and body. So he's a neuroscientist, and I go to him for information all the time. And one of the things that Dr. Blaylock told me that is absolutely shocking, so much so that I've hardly mentioned on television because I'm being so attacked for having the audacity to say that there are ways other than chemotherapy to deal with cancer. But he said, if I were a woman, I would never have a mammogram. And I said, what? He said, if a woman starts at age 40 with no cancer and has a mammogram every year, by the time she's 50, she will have increased her chances of getting breast cancer by 33 1/3%. He said, also, the act of smashing the breast the way we do with, like in a panini machine with a mammogram, he said, if you have a tumor in there, he said, that very process of smashing can break the tumor and metastasize the cancer. He said, I said, well, what do we do if we can't have mammograms? He said, first you have an ultrasound, you have a thermogram if there's any hot spots, then you have an ultrasound, if there are any shadows, then you have an MRI. I said, well, we can't afford MRIs. He said, if the new gold standard became MRIs, he said, then they would be affordable. He said, because there's no radiation and you see a clearer picture in an MRI. He said, the cumulative effect of radiation from mammograms is actually giving women cancer, and no one wants us to know about that. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Suzanne, trying to understand the complexities of an illness like cancer can be extremely daunting and downright scary for people who are not doctors or medical professionals. What advice would you give patients that can help them to decipher the information that they're being presented with?
Well, I don't give advice, but what's important for me, having been a patient twice, being diagnosed with this horrible disease, is my advantage of having information. If I had been a different kind of patient, Kathleen, when this doctor earlier this year wanted to start me on full body chemotherapy that day, I probably would have taken it. But because I have a lot of information, I was able to stand back and say, first, I know that I have time to think this through, and I'm going to look for other options before I would ever consider that. So information, especially with cancer, because you have to look at the present cancer protocol. We've thrown billions and billions of dollars, maybe trillions at this point, into cancer research, and there's no cure. There's the death rate has dropped 5% in the last 55 years. That's a failure. After all this money, and they can't come up with anything other than they send attack doctors after me and saying, well, we're making strides and we're extending life. And I go, where are the strides? And what does extending life mean? Extending life means 1 to 4 months, maybe, of horrible, degraded quality of life. Can they really be proud of that? So my feeling is that perhaps, no one wants to say it's like the emperor's new clothes, but perhaps we've been barking up the wrong tree. Maybe these little guys, these doctors that I've found, who are Western doctors who've broken away from standard of care, who get persecuted, who get ridiculed by their peers because they're daring to do something different, maybe they're onto something, because they certainly can't declare success in the present cancer protocol other than the three kinds of cancer that do respond to chemo, which is testicular, childhood leukemia, lymphomas, and non-Hodgkin's.
Now, you did a lot of research for Knockout and conducted many interviews. What did you learn that surprised you the most?
That there are chemosensitivity tests. I never heard of that. They're not given in this country. And I said, why? To this one PhD I interviewed, he said, I'm just the messenger. He said, it's too expensive and it takes too much time. I said, but if you're going to put a body through this rigorous chemotherapy, don't we at least want to know it's the right fit? He said, yes, but you have to understand, you have to get many, many petri dishes, put their blood in all those different petri dishes, and then just try to find the right chemical configuration. He said, they do it in Germany, they do it in Greece. Now, my friend Farrah Fawcett called me a year ago, and she said, do you know anything about German medicine? I said, I do, and I gave her the name of that clinic. She chose on her own to go to Germany to do this. She said, I've had three grueling rounds of chemotherapy, 24 weeks of it. I've had three grueling rounds of radiation. And she said, for anal cancer, it's grueling. She said, and now my cancer's back with a vengeance. She goes over to Germany. They do a chemosensitivity test on Farah and find that the chemotherapy she had been given was absolutely ineffective. Now, wouldn't it have been better had we done this before she started on her chemo regimen to know that it's not going to work and she could have looked at something else? So if I was going to go standard of care, chemotherapy, radiation, et cetera, as a patient, I would demand that I have a chemosensitivity test. I think everybody who's undergoing chemo should demand having a chemosensitivity test and have their blood sent off to either Germany or France.
That's definitely important to know. Suzanne, if there is any one thing that you would like readers to take away from your book, Knockout, what would it be?
That at the end of writing Knockout, it took away my fear of cancer. If reading Knockout can do that for all of you who are going to read it, then I would have succeeded, because rather than cowering the corner when you're diagnosed, roll up your sleeves, do your homework, do the reading, look into whatever other people are doing, and then make an informed decision. It makes you more powerful that way. It gives you control over your life, your disease, and your body.
All right, the book is called Knockout, Interviews with Doctors Who Are Curing Cancer and How to Prevent Getting It in the First Place. Suzanne Summers, congratulations on yet another successful book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for watching Newsmax TV.
Okay, that was Suzanne Summers, and her books are really good. They're top quality and well-informed. So I'd advise anyone, if you can get your hands on them, to read them. They're very, very informative. And cancer is a big problem today. I know people have other little worries to worry about, but you should concern yourself with the amount of cancer that's going around. Right now, one in two men will experience cancer in this lifetime, and one in three women. So every year it gets worse and worse and worse. If you go back 50 or more years, there was very little cancer around in the old days. And like Suzanne Summers says, they have made very little progress except for a few cancers, non-leukemia. Except for a few, all the other cancers have gotten worse. And we might, like she says, we're barking up the wrong tree. There's a huge amount of money. A person who has cancer spends about something like $50,000 a year, I think, or as far as I know, it's a year, treating the cancer. So there's a huge industry have grown up dependent on cancer, or on people getting cancer. And so they're not, in a lot of cases, they're not so interested in finding a cure, because it gives money and employment to so many different people. So I'm afraid that, you know, just like the religions, the religion of medicine is also corrupt. And anyway, her book on cancer is called Knockout. And we're now going to move on to some more music. And we have Josh Groban on our sights, and this time he's going to sing a song called Mahi. I played it in the last program, but it's a nice song. We'll try it again. Oh, I hear a little hum. We've had some technical problems here at the studio, and there's a hum comes out sometimes. We're trying to fix it.
Guardarmi, non cercare di spiegare, lo sapevo che finiva prima o poi, e solo ieri che dicevi quanto ti amo, ma era soltanto uno stato di agonia. Non c'è cosa più illusoria dell'amore, Non credi mai che possa capitare a te di ritrovarti sopra un filo di speranza, per poi crollare dentro questa oscurità. Adesso sembri così preoccupata, si direbbe che ora soffri più di me, ma non è vero, non mi hai mai nemmeno amato, altrimenti non andresti via così.
Okay, that was Joss Gobin and singing a song called Mahi. I don't know what the word Mahi means. It sounds like it's a Hawaiian word to me, not being a linguist. Maybe somebody out there knows what it means. Maybe I'll try to look it up. I suppose it could be Spanish or, yeah. Anyway, it's a nice song. We played it before, but I'd like to hear it again. And now we're going to... We're going over to the spiritual side of the program, and we're going to have Master Spira. He's going to talk to us about I had it lined up here and something moved, so if you just give me a minute. Yeah, the name of the talk is Does Free Will Exist? And I've heard the arguments for and against this for years, and this is a slightly different angle, so listen carefully, okay? And you get an idea.
Some something similar to this. You have allowed yourself to be entangled with an object, and you believe you are this object. There are a couple of questions I have around that. At the moment you were said you, who were you speaking to? And with the word allow, and you used it this morning, which brought my hand up, allow to me implies that there's also disallow, which implies some sort of control. So would you speak to those two things?
You see, it's not absolutely true to say that we have allowed our true nature to be veiled, because from the point of view of our true nature, it only knows itself. From its point of view, which is the only real point of view, there is no veiling of itself, and therefore there is no ignorance or ignoring of itself. So the statement, we have allowed ourselves, or we have allowed ourselves to become entangled with the body and the mind, is a concession to the apparently separate self that believes and feels itself to be temporary and finite. It is to that apparent one that we believe and feel ourselves to be that the statement is made. You have allowed yourself to become entangled with thoughts and feelings. Now, the implication, as you rightly point out in the phrase, you have allowed yourself to become entangled, is the possibility that you could not allow, that you could choose not to become entangled, which then raises the question, does I, the separate self, have the free will to choose whether or not I become entangled with the body-mind? Again, the statement that you have the freedom to choose whether you are entangled with thoughts and feelings or not is a concession to the separate self we believe and feel ourselves to be. As a concession to that one, it is said, you have the choice. You have consented to limit yourself. You can choose not to. Now, the reason it is said in this way to the separate self is because from the separate self's point of view, it has choice, freedom. The separate self feels that it has the freedom to choose. That is implicit in the separate self. A separate self that says, I feel that I have no free will or choice, is making a contradiction. The separate self, by definition, feels that it is choosing. And therefore, the teaching says, okay, you feel you have the freedom to choose. Choose to disentangle yourself. Make that your first choice in life, to disentangle yourself from the body and the mind, and to know yourself as you truly are. When the mind returns to the heart, when the separate self is divested of its separateness and it stands revealed as the true and only self of pure awareness, then it becomes clear that there was never a separate self to begin with. And therefore the question as to whether that separate self has choice or not is
mute.
However, we shouldn't fall into the very common trap that a lot of contemporary Advaita teachings fall into, which is to believe and feel that I am a separate self, and to appropriate the non-dual understanding, there is no free will or choice, and to mix these two beliefs together, one, the belief that I am a separate self, and two, the belief, because from the point of view of the separate self, it is a belief that I have no free will or choice. So we mix these two beliefs together, and we end up with a statement, I, the separate self, have no choice. And we end up with this nihilistic, depressing view of contemporary Advaita that we may as well just go down to the pub, as opposed to coming to satsang. It's know. If we think we are a separate self, we should be honest. We, by definition, feel that we are making choices. And as that apparently separate self, the highest choice we can make is to turn our attention away from the objects that we seem to know towards the knowing with which they are known. That choice, to make that choice, affects this disentanglement of ourself from the body-mind, and we stand, our true nature stands revealed as it is.
It seems that most of us make that choice to be entangled somewhere. I mean, for me it was very unconscious, it appears, but as you know, as we walk around this earth and are here in our separate selves, that seems like a very common choice people make. Does that?
Yes. it's a common choice, and it's a less common choice to refuse to consent to being limited by the body and the mind. But that choice is open to everybody. At any moment, the possibility to turn the light of our attention around on itself in order to know the nature of ourself, that is, the nature of the knowing with which we know our experience. It's an open door. Once we have consented to limit ourselves in time and space and become, as a result, a temporary finite entity that lives in and as the body, we are then destined to experience in a way that is consistent with that consent. And as such, we are destined to suffer. In fact, the experience of suffering is itself like a wake-up call. It is like a red flag telling us, stop. You have mistaken yourself. You have consented to limit yourself to a mind and a body. That is what the experience of suffering tells us. So once that consent has been made, we are then destined to experience all the pleasures and pains that the separate self goes through. However, that separate self always has the choice to turn around and step out of that entanglement and to question its true nature, and therefore to step out of the destiny of being a separate self. This is why Krishnamurti titled one of his books, The First and Last Freedom. When we consent to become a separate self, that is, when we consent to take on or assume the limitations that properly belong to the body and the mind, we lose our true freedom. And we are bound as a result to suffer, to enjoy and suffer as a separate self. So that is our last freedom. We give up our freedom. However, at every moment, the first possibility of all separate selves is to direct the knowing with which they know their experience back towards itself. That is the first freedom that all separate selves have. And it is a freedom that is always available to us.
You know, I don't remember making that consenting. But looking back, I'm wondering, why would I give up freedom?
You see, it's not a choice that you made in the past. It's a choice that we make moment by moment. Don't think, oh, I made this choice 40 years ago, and I have been suffering the consequences ever since. This is a choice we make moment by moment.
Thank you.
And therefore, moment by moment, we can choose not to make that choice.
Thank you.
Just to know a few notes on that talk. Once you become entangled or identified with your body and your mind, then you start to lose your freedom. Sure, the body has restrictions, has limitations, so has the mind, so has thought. Thought and the body, they're both forms. But the real self is not a form, it's consciousness. It's spirit, if you want to use that word. And once it gets identified with form, it starts to lose its freedom. And that's why it suffers, because if you're in your pure pristine state, there's no suffering really, because you're basically in alignment with consciousness or spirit, and the nature of that is bliss, is inner fulfillment, happiness, bliss, happiness and bliss. So once you start to lose that freedom and that happiness and that bliss, once you lose contact with that, then you take upon yourself identification with the body, with the mind. And the goal of these exercises that we give out and the goal of this program is to help people disentangle from their false self, the illusionary self that Buddha talked about, and come in contact with their real, pure, pristine self, and to recapture the inner freedom, recapture the inner peace, recapture the bliss and happiness, and the compassion for other people. So that is the spiritual awakening of man. That was the spiritual awakening of Buddha. And it's the spiritual awakening of every man and woman. So that's a reason to take this knowledge seriously, and especially the exercise and guided meditation. Okay. See where we are right now. You know, one of my computers is not working, and so I'm kind of restricted. But so far we're doing okay, and I usually try to set the programs before the show, but today I haven't really had the time to do that, so we're kind of setting it up as we go, and so we call on the universe to for guidance so that we can get the best information out there we can.
Holy night, the stars are bright.
Celine Dion.
It is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long live the world in sin and their pining, till He appears.
Oh,
Yeah, that was Celine Dion singing "Oh Silent Holy Night." That was quite a nice song, I thought, by her. You know, I think I'd try to play that so that we could help move some people into the spirit of Christmas. I think at Christmas time, people's heart open a little fraction more than they normally are. I know, you know, I moved from the Midwest, basically, over to California coast, and I find that the people here, their hearts, I'm in Santa Cruz, but the people here, their hearts are more open than where I used to live. So it's that invisible force that moves you around wherever you're harmoniously aligned with. So I must have grown a little bit to be moved into such a nice community of people. Anyway, the next talk we're going to have is the spiritual exercise of this program. I've played it before, but I like it, and I'm playing it again. So when you hear that bell go like that, that means that we're coming into a spiritual exercise that I'd advise you to do between the programs at home. And these exercises will forward your consciousness to a higher level.
Almost all the time, this I am is contacting the mind, is going to the mind. And at least you begin to see the influence and the presence also of the habit of associating with the mind. But don't give up. Postman come today. Dear Muji, please speak about meditation. Love from Tov. About meditation. Best meditation, simple meditation, anybody can do it. But we're not going to call it meditation. I don't want to use a name because it becomes something else. But the best, if what you're asking, this feeling, the natural feeling of being inside this body, the sense I exist, it is common to all the sentient beings have this feeling, I exist. Not just the words, I exist, the intuition, the feeling of presence, the way in which you know you are alive. Nobody gave it to you. It just is present. It is the voice of the life force and the consciousness. It is saying, I am. This pulsation is inside. Only after this arises, then perception of otherness can come. This is the earliest manifestation of the Absolute. In the dance of multiplicity. This must first be there, the original seed, the seed of existence. The feeling I am or I is synonymous with that, it's identical. You are to know this. When you say I is consciousness. It is the godly principle in the form. It is already there. It is already there. But it reveals itself in the waking state. And in the dreaming state, when consciousness is available, it manifests itself as I. So I and consciousness, they are one. Know that. Somehow, as soon as consciousness makes itself known to itself as the feeling I am, it gets associated with the body. It starts to identify with the body and start to feel I am the body. But it is not the body. It is only I am. It is only I am. But it says, I am the body. And once this I am the body feeling forms, a new identification arises as me, the person, the personal. This is a modification arising out of the pure feeling, the intuition, I am. I just want to say this thing. And it becomes now, even when the feeling is there, I am the body, this I am the body feeling comes out of consciousness. It is supported by consciousness. And this is why the personality feels real. Not because it by itself is real, but because the root of the personality is the consciousness. And it is the consciousness that you love. I was making an example a few days ago. I said, if a being came and said, I am very pleased with you, so much so that I'm offering you the entire world. I give it to you because I love you so much. But one thing, you have to exchange what I have to give you for consciousness. I give you the universe, you give me your consciousness. Would it be of any value for you? No. Because without consciousness, nothing, no perception, nothing can be tasted, not even the sense of existence will be there for you like this. So the consciousness is that important, and it is already established. You don't have to go somewhere else to find consciousness. That is foolishness, because the very I that you feel is itself consciousness. But because this consciousness has somehow developed a limitation onto itself by identifying with the body, it starts to look for consciousness. This is how absurd it all becomes, when the identity, I am the body, is functioning, and you don't realize that this arises out of a purer consciousness, unassociated consciousness. So having said this, I leave it there for a moment. I'm going to tell you what I have to tell you now. The sense I am is already there with you, unsupported. It is there. But it has a tendency, a kind of reflex, to identify as the body. And you must watch this. Try to isolate the feeling I am. And don't let it contact any other concept, belief, memory, intention, desire, attachment, images. Keep it by itself. Just a feeling of being. Now, I know how easy that becomes. But maybe sometimes you may feel this is very difficult to do. Because when I try to do this, I realize how attached I am to my mind. Almost all the time, this I am is contacting the mind, is going to the mind. And at least you begin to see the influence and the presence also of the habit of associating with the mind. But don't give up. Feel the sense of existence, natural sense I am. Just here, it is here with you. Inseparable from you. When you say I, this is the real source and being of I. It is consciousness. And it is formless. It is formless. But when it's in the body, it starts to believe I am the body. So don't be aware of this I am the body feeling. Leave it. Leave it be there. This I am the body feeling is appearing in the consciousness itself. Just feel the natural sense I am, and don't associate it with anything else. In the beginning, some people find a lot of noise come, like a tsunami of thought come. That is okay. In fact, don't be disturbed by this. Why this comes is because of the very power of trying to isolate the I am. Keep this exercise going, and gradually you'll begin to feel a sense of separation. Just the feeling of presence and the feeling, the closeness of thoughts will feel like they're drifting away, and the presence will feel more strengthened. Stay with this, and what you will come to see gradually is the feeling I am the body, or I am an object, or anything else become weak, and only there is a supreme beautiful presence here, unassociated. And the perfume arising out of this isolation of the intuition of the feeling I am, the perfume coming out is peace and natural joy, spaciousness, and an intuitive knowing or conviction that I have no beginning and end. You will know this. Don't study this. Don't look at it in a book. You will know it arising out of your own book. Just this you do. Not 3, 4, 5 things. Hold on only to the sense I am. Allow it to marinate in itself. Don't add any more herbs and spices from anywhere else. Let it stay by itself. You can call it meditation or nothing. Don't call it nothing. Just do this. Don't put any titles around it. Don't try and make it into something special. Just by yourself you do this. If you sit quietly 5, 7 minutes, get used to this feeling. Because the beingness, it enjoys to be by itself. For a while it is in association with these other qualities, but these qualities, they are temporary. Then these qualities and the association with them begin to disturb the being. It wants to get rid of them. So this simple exercise of keeping the beingness to itself, this is the most beautiful, most powerful, most potent meditation, you can call this thing. But don't tell anybody it's meditation, just you do it. Soon you are going to love it so much that you will not want to practice anything else. Just do this. This is the first, most potent and simple aspect of self-inquiry. It is an aspect of self-inquiry. And it is the simplest instruction anybody can give you about this. Because it doesn't matter what religion you come from, doesn't matter what things you believe, even if you're an atheist, you can practice this. And you will come to find that fullness of being and presence. So sometimes I send people out, okay, go, you go with this now. Don't forget about anything else. Don't practice any mantras, don't do anything else. Just you stay with this, practice this, come back in a few days and share your findings with me. Just this. So I think that will deal with this question for the moment. This is enough for that. Anything else people will tell you, oh, there's another minute, forget about it. Anything more than this you don't need. Somebody will tell you, oh, there's another kind of meditation on the blue light, forget about it. Because the blue light will be seen by the I Am. The I Am is there first. The blue light is not seeing the I Am. The I Am is seeing the blue light. You will come to know the earliest. Everything else is secondary. Everything else you're perceiving is secondary, momentary. They come and go. They are appearances. And only this, the I Amness itself, will lose all its, all the different garments, all the different colors that it's associating with. Like Eric was saying, and now I just want to be, I don't want more clothing now. This is what he's speaking. Don't want more thoughts. I don't want more belief. Don't want more experience. Just want to be naked. Mean, I don't want to associate with anything.
Okay, I like to hear that talk actually every so often because it kind of crystallizes what the spiritual path is about. There's two aspects to our beingness, to our being. One is obviously the mind and its chit chatter and its continuous useless thoughts. In a lot of cases, these thoughts, a lot of them, it's been shown don't go anywhere. They're not practical and they don't go anywhere. They're just taking up our attention. So, and then the other part of our being is this more peaceful, more silent being, the I Amness, I existness, that's naturally there. But often if we don't access it too well because the mind is giving us all these thoughts. For me, I find, you know, everyone has to find out basically for what works for them. And you should spend a certain amount of time during the day or night in this state of beingness as much as you possibly can. And it's important to be able to connect to the silence, to the isness, to the beingness, Because what it does is it rebalances your body, mind, and emotions. And the best time for me to have that experience is, four or five in the morning. And that's why I tend to go to bed a bit earlier so I can wake up at these times, at 3, 4, and 5 in the morning. And I find that I can access this beingness easier. My mind is not so, agitated and so full of thoughts. So try that at home. See what you think about that time of the night, 3, 4, 5, early in the day. You can always go back to sleep if you want to, but you have to go to bed earlier to be able to wake up refreshed at that time. You know, there's not much point in waking up and being totally groggy. It's better to wake up refreshed, and you might want 5 or 6 hours sleep. Who knows? Everyone's a little different. All right, now we're back again here to the music, and as we have Celine Dion on the block, as it were, we're going to play one of her most famous songs, "My Heart Will Go On." That's actually from the movie The Titanic. I hope you enjoy this one. I do. A little bit of a lean up to the song itself, and so it's coming.
Spaces between us, you have come.
You know, this music is about opening the heart, and music is part of that. We give out some self-inquiry knowledge to actually open the heart and to become a more complete person. But music is very much a part of this program as well. So I try to pick the most beautiful music I know about or I can find. So hopefully that is helping, will help your inner consciousness or your heart as well. That was Celine Dion singing My Heart Will Go On from the original soundtrack of the movie Titanic. You've probably seen it. Most people have. All right, now we're going to have a series from Dr. Michael Gerber. I believe that's his name, if my memory serves me well. And we're going to have a look at short clips of what I consider important health subjects. So the first one is... The first one is to do with beans. Beans are a very important food, not only for diabetics, but for everyone. And there's evidence there that the beans actually help you prolong your life, if that's what you're interested in.
Australia. And of all the food factors they looked at, only one...
I'm going back to the beginning again. There we go.
Legumes may be the most important predictor of survival in older people from around the globe. They looked at 5 different cohorts in Japan, Sweden, Greece, and Australia. And of all the food factors they looked at, only one was associated with a longer lifespan across the board: legume intake. Whether it was the Japanese eating their soy, the Swedes eating their brown beans and peas, or those in the Mediterranean eating lentils, chickpeas, and white beans. Only for legumes intake was the result plausible, consistent, and statistically significant from the data across all the populations combined. We're talking an 8% reduction in risk of death for every 20 grams increase in daily legumes intake. That's just like 2 tablespoons worth. So if a can of beans is 250 grams and you get 8% lower mortality for every 20 grams, maybe if we eat a can a day, we'll live forever? Let's find out. If you want to increase your lifespan, eat beans. If, however, you're suicidal and want to decrease your lifespan, a bean-free diet may increase the risk of death. So, having arrived at the one dietary fountain of youth, what's the number one reason people aren't clamoring for them? Fear of flatulence. So is that the choice we're left with? Breaking wind or breaking down? Passing gas or passing on? Turns out that people's concerns about excessive flatulence from eating beans may be exaggerated. Add a half a cup of beans every day to people's diet for months, and what happens? What's the number one symptom? Nothing. The vast majority of people experienced no symptoms at all, though a few percent did report increased flatulence. So it may occur in some individuals, but not all people are affected. And even among those that were, 70% or more of the participants who experienced flatulence felt it dissipated, no pun intended, by the second or third week of bean consumption. So we just gotta stick to it. And you know, a small percentage reported increased flatulence on the control diet without any beans. People have preconceived notions about beans, such that just the expectation of flatulence from eating beans may influence their perceptions of having gas. They didn't actually measure farts in the study. They just asked people what their perception of the amount of gas they had was. And we know from previous studies that you give someone a product labeled to contain something that may cause intestinal distress, and it causes more intestinal distress whether it actually contains the ingredient or not. In other words, just thinking they were eating it caused digestive distress, or the perception of it, to a proportion of persons. So, people thinking beans are going to cause gas may just be more likely to notice the gas they normally have. Either way, it tends to go away. After a few weeks of daily bean consumption, people perceive their flatulence occurrence returns to normal levels. In this other study, where they added more than half a cup of kidney beans to people's daily diets, the research subjects reported that the discomfort they initially felt within the first day or two of adding beans quickly disappeared. So again, stick with it. Bottom line, no pun intended, an increasing body of research in the latest dietary guidelines supports the benefits of a plant-based diet, and legumes specifically, in the reduction of chronic disease risks. In some people, it may result in more flatulence initially. However, doctors should emphasize that it will decrease over time if we just keep it up, and the nutritional attributes of beans in the diet outweighs the potential for transitory discomfort. The long-term health benefits of bean consumption are great. And indeed, eating beans in the long term may make your term on Earth even longer. The cheapest way to get our B12 is probably 2,500 microgram sublingual chewable or liquid supplement of cyanocobalamin once a week. This stuff is dirt cheap. You can find a 20-year supply online for $40. All the B12 our body needs for $2 a year. Of course, the stuff doesn't last 20 years. There's a 4-year expiration date, so share it with some friends. For those mathematically minded who are thinking, wait a second, if you only need 47 micrograms a day, why do you have to take 2,500 a week? Well, it's a little complicated, but let's do it. Our B12 receptors become saturated at as little as 1.5, so we can only absorb 1.5 at a time through our receptor system. But about 1% of the rest passively diffuses right through our gut into our bloodstream. So, for those of you into this kind of thing, let's do the math. When we take a 2,500 microgram dose, we absorb 1.5 through our receptor system, and then 1% of the 2,498.5 that's left. So inside our body, we now have 1.5 plus that 1% comes out to be about 26.5. You do that once a week, and that averages to about 4 micrograms a day. So we should take at least 2,500 micrograms once a week. We could take 3,000 a week, 5,000. If you take too much, all you get is expensive pee. And at a couple bucks a year, it's not even that expensive. Even though it is a water-soluble vitamin, we don't have to take it every day, because throughout our evolution, our bodies were so used to getting such tiny amounts, you know, maybe some woolly mammoth pooped upstream or something, that our body devised an ingenious way to hold on to it. So that's why we can do this kind of averaging over time.
All right, sorry, I was talking to you out there, and I forgot to press the button here, or slide the lever, and so I was essentially talking to myself, because my voice wasn't going out, so sorry about the silent gap there. All right, so I'm just looking for another one here from the same kind of source. We'll have to play three together, and so let's see. Is coffee bad for you? I think everyone wants to know about coffee and tea, so we'll concentrate on that for a little bit.
What about 2 cups of filtered coffee every morning with that oatmeal? Coffee has historically been a confusing story, originally linked to bladder and ovarian cancer, but that turned out to be just because coffee drinkers tended to be smokers. Coffee may cause heartburn and worsen osteoporosis, but it may protect against diabetes, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. To sip or not to sip? What do you think, based on the latest research? Do you think it's harmful? Harmless? Helpful? Based on the latest science, helpful. Now, note this is for filtered coffee, though. There are some substances in coffee that can raise our cholesterol, but they're filtered out in the paper. So, brewed coffee may be okay, but coffee from a French press or espresso may not be.
That was short and sweet. And
which is healthier, though? Black coffee or black tea?
Okay, the next one.
Do you think the latest research has found that coffee's healthier? Tea? Tea is much healthier. But are there some teas better for you than others? Black versus green. Who says black tea is healthier? Green tea? Green tea is better than black, and the best form of green tea may be what's called white tea, so white tea may be the best of the best.
Okay, that's a tea. Green tea is better?
It's also from the tea plant, but it's been processed, so green is better. But there are 2 types of green tea. That is, 2 types of unprocessed leaves of the tea plant. Tea from mature leaves, known as green tea, and tea from young leaves, known as white tea, because of the little white hairs on the immature leaves. Which is healthier? It turns out it depends on whether you add lemon or not. If you drink your tea without lemon, green appears preferable to white. But if you add lemon, the white tea jumps ahead. It turns out while there may be more phytonutrients in the white tea, they may only be released at the right pH. Regardless of which tea you drink, though, adding lemon boosts the nutrition.
Okay, the next one.
Who cares how much nutrition is extracted from tea leaves, though, if you eat the leaves themselves? We know that drinking tea is good for you. What about eating it? Matcha, powdered green tea, invented in China about 1,000 years ago, transplanted to Japan. Whole leaves of tea milled into fine powder. You dump a spoonful of water, and then drink the whole thing down. Now, it sounds like a good idea. Why waste nutrition throwing away tea leaves when you're done, when you can drink them whole? Or were tea leaves just not meant to be eaten? Powdered green tea leaves. Harmful, harmless, or helpful? Super helpful and easy. Carry around little packets of matcha wherever you go. Just dump them in your water bottle. You add 0 calories. At the same time, you're adding whopping loads of nutrition. I carry them around wherever I go. Never leave home without it.
Okay, I think that last point is really important. You know, you can make these minor changes and really support your health just by the type of tea you drink. In this case, it's matcha. You can buy it in the store. It's a powder green tea, and then, like you said, you can just take it away around with you, and when you want something to drink, you put a spoon into your water bottle and then fill it up, put some water in, and away you go. And this is enhances the antioxidants in your body. So you can have the anti-inflammatory effect, anti-cancer effect, and all the other positive effects. So this is just by a simple thing like that, you can make big changes in your health. Now we'll go on for another one or two. This is the latest information you're getting, the up-to-date information.
What about something a little more familiar? Hibiscus tea, which is what puts the zing in red zinger tea. Harmful, harmless, or helpful? Once again, wonderful stuff. Speaking of potential DNA damage, fact or fiction? Cell phones can give you brain cancer. The incidence of brain tumors has been increasing over the last 25 years, but is it because of mobile phones? Fact or fiction? Fact. A major review in the International Journal of Oncology was published last year. If you don't use cell phones, your lifetime risk of developing a brain tumor is about 1 in 167. If you do use cell phones, your lifetime risk is still really small, but it goes up from 1 in 167 to 1 in 128. That's still less than a 1% chance you're ever going to get a brain tumor, but it's best to use a headset or the speakerphone option and limit the time children use them.
Yesterday, before
afraid of the dark.
It did say Pai Isu, but that was a different song. But still, it was a nice song. It's Katherine Jenkins. I forgot the name of that song. I walk on. Next, we're going to have a guided meditation from Master Muji. So if you would find a comfortable position, you know, sit in an easy chair, or if you need to lie down, you could, except don't fall asleep. And if you might find it helpful to close your eyes, just follow along with the instruction. It's a guided meditation, and it'll help you to...
intention. Simply here. If thoughts appear, this is natural. Let them rise. But you have nothing to do with that. Stay as you are. Do not follow thoughts. Any sensation that occur is merely like a cloud floating in the infinite sky. Your self-presence is like this sky. Unchanging. The presence you are is not waiting for anything to happen. There is no next. Whatever appears is not you, but is noticed in your being. There's nothing to do or to change. No practice, no intention. No construction.
whatever sensations or thoughts arise or appear, simply let them happen. There's nothing to control, nothing to organize, nothing to push away, nothing to keep. There is no job for you. Notice the sense of unmixed presence. Formless. Immeasurable. Your presence is like space. There's neither in nor out. Your own body and senses are inside this space. All is well. All is perfect. As it is, nothing more needed. There is nothing to wait for. There is no journey to make. Nothing more to find. There is no need to imagine. If there is any sensations in the body, notice this without interpretation.
notice how, without intention, all the senses are silent. All is well as it is. Being aware of the world, you are not the world. Being aware of the body, you are not merely the body. Being aware of the senses, you are beyond the senses. Being aware of thought, you are beyond thought. Being aware of feeling, you are beyond feeling. Being aware of time, you are beyond time. Being aware of space, you are beyond space. Being aware of I, you're beyond I. Being aware of images, you're beyond image. If there's a feeling of tiredness or sleep or strain in the body, you're simply aware of this. You are not this. Stay only as awareness. You are without form, without intention, without quality. There is nowhere to go. There's nothing to keep. There's nothing to know.
there's nothing to heal. There is nothing behind you. There is neither front, nor back, nor side, nor out, nor in, nor above, nor below. There's nothing to attain. There is no name for this that you are. There is no bondage here, nor freedom here. Pure awareness only, beyond all concepts.
Okay, that was guided meditation. And I know there were some gaps of silence in there. I hope that was okay. It's usually I preview these tapes. I previewed the tapes, but I didn't tonight. So anyway, I'm sure it wasn't too long for you, hopefully. All right, now next we're going to... we're getting towards the end of the show. But we do have Catherine Jenkins still queued up here. And this one is called Time to Say Goodbye from the Phantom of the Opera by Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Quando sono solo sogno l'orizzonte mancan le parole. Sì, lo so che non c'è luce in una stanza quando manca il sole. Se non ci sei tu con me su le finestre mostrai tutto il mio cuore che hai acceso. Chiudi dentro me la luce che ho incontrato per strada. Time.
mancano parole. E io sì lo so che sei con me, tu mia luna, tu sei qui con me. Mio sole, tu sei qui con me.
Time to say goodbye. Hola, I got a phone call coming in here. Hang on a second. Hello?
Hi, I always enjoy your show, Monterey.
Okay, that's good. Who am I talking to?
This is Charles in Monterey.
Charles.
I wanted to know, how do you spell the master moji?
M-O-O-J-I. And all these masters that I play here will be found on YouTube. All you have to do is punch in Muji, M-O-O-J-I, and you'll see all his talks. So if you want to, progress your knowledge, that's the way to go. And also at the end of the show, I'll be giving out, there's also a very good site called Buddha at the Gas Pump. And it's by, his name, Rick Archer. And they interview probably more than 300 different spiritual teachers. So you're bound to find somebody that interests you on that site. It's called Buddha at the Gas Pump. It's a very excellent site. All right, and was your name Steve?
Charles.
Oh, Charles. Thanks for calling in, Charles. Call again.
Thank you, bye.
Yeah, bye, Charles. Okay, we're almost at the end of the show, so I do have one more piece I'm going to play, and that is The Remedy for Fear of Debt is Very Simple. We touched that subject a few programs ago, but now we get it from a better source. This is Rupert Spira, and it's from a talk 1960. It's quite an old talk, but here she goes.
For the fear of death is very simple. Are you afraid of going to sleep at night? All your thoughts, your feelings, your ideas.
Sound is not coming out very loud.
Your world.
I'm wondering, maybe I turned it down with that
phone
call.
Everything you know about yourself. All the knowledge that you have accumulated, all your hopes.
Yes, I did.
Is going to disappear.
I'm going to start it again. Here we go.
The remedy for the fear of death is very simple. Are you afraid of going to sleep at night? All your thoughts, your feelings, your ideas, your name, your form, your world. Everything you know about yourself. all the knowledge that you have accumulated, all your hopes, everything is going to disappear. And yet, not only do you not fear it, you actually look forward to it. Why do you look forward to it? It's such a relief when it all disappears. It's such a burden to carry that around all day long. That's why we look forward to the peace of sleep. When you fall asleep, do you feel reluctant, afraid to cease to exist? Why don't you feel that? Because you don't experience it. It is your repeated experience that when you go to sleep, you do not cease to be. Everything you have carried around with yourself, all your knowledge, all your ideas, all your sensations, all your perceptions, they give you a break. And that's why it's so peaceful there. So why are you afraid to die? Why are you afraid that such a collection of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and perceptions disappear? The reason we fear it is because we have invested our identity in something that comes and goes. We have invested our identity in an object or a collection of objects, ideas and knowledge and history, and collections of sensations that we know as the body. Our essential being of pure awareness has mixed itself up with a collection of thoughts and feelings to such an extent that it can no longer distinguish itself apart from those thoughts and feelings. Instead of thinking, I have thoughts and feelings, we feel, I am thoughts and feelings. Instead of thinking and feeling that thoughts, feelings, sensations, or perceptions are things that visit me from time to time and then leave me, leaving me in the peace of my true nature, we feel instead, I am this cluster of thoughts, feelings, and sensations called this body-mind. And therefore, when it disappears, which it does regularly, we feel a little bit of me is going to go with it, because I have invested my identity in them. We feel that I am going to disappear, or I am going to die. And this is one of the essential forms of the separate self, this feeling that I am going to disappear. The other essential form of the separate self is that I lack something. Because an object can never be complete. There's no such thing as a complete object. So whenever we identify ourselves as an object, we feel not only a sense of fear, but we also feel that we are incomplete. Fear and desire are the two essential activities of the separate self. The sense of separation expresses itself as the fear of disappearing. In other people, the longing, seeking aspect is stronger than the fear aspect. The remedy for this situation is to know what you essentially are. Go to the experience of being aware and see that that experience has never left you. In fact, there's not a you that has that experience. That is you. This is simple, the presence of knowing. The awareness of being, or the experience of being aware, it's just totally constant in your life. It's never been extinguished. It's never gone anywhere. It's only if we allow that to become mixed up with a collection of thoughts and feelings, so exclusively that we can no longer distinguish the difference between them, that we then fear disappearance. The remedy for this fear is very simple. Just look at yourself. Ask yourself, what do I refer to when I say I? Go there. Take the thought I. I am aware of my body. I am aware of this room. I am aware of these words. I am aware of my feelings. I am aware of my thoughts. I am aware of, I am aware of, I am aware of, I am aware of. That's all your life consists of. I am aware of this. I am aware of that. I am aware of being healthy. I am aware of being wealthy. This I am aware pervades your entire experience. There is no experience without it. Instead of giving your attention to what you are aware of, no, emphasize the I am aware. Let the thoughts just go out of focus. Focus on the first part of your experience. Just stop with the I am aware. Irrespective of what you are aware of, it has never left you. You have never ceased to be this I am aware. Just give your attention to that experience of being aware, instead of shining your attention on the object, the thought, the feeling. Shine that awareness on the experience of being aware. In other words, on itself. Allow your attention to come back to itself, just to rest in itself. That experience is peace itself. As you abide that, as that, more and more, your old identity, your old belief that this aware being is identical to a cluster of thoughts and feelings will just gradually purify itself of all those thoughts and feelings. You don't have to do anything to them. You don't have to get rid of them. You don't have to worry about this old identity. It will just gradually wither away as a result of neglect, because it is no longer being fed by your attention or interest. Give your loving attention to yourself, to this that you know you are, that knows itself in you as the experience, I am aware. That's the cure for the fear of death. Because as you abide as this being aware, from the background, this certainty begins to emerge. It's like a memory that comes from the depths of your being. This memory of your own immortality, of your own eternity, that I am not just aware, I am eternally aware. I have never experienced myself disappearing. I have never been hurt. I have never been harmed. No experience has ever stained me or left a trace on me. I'm totally intimate with all experience. Just a witnessing presence in the background of experience that has to hold the body-mind world at a safe distance. I am the knowing which floods all experience, which pervades all experience, that is intimately one with all experience. I take the shape of all experience. Every experience just leaves me in my pristine, open, empty, shiny, knowing presence. Abide that, this memory, not a memory from the past, but this memory from the depths of your being, as a kind of, it will formulate itself in your mind as a kind of conviction. I never go anywhere. I cannot be harmed. I don't die. You'll just forget about your fear of death. It just will no longer visit you.
Okay, that was Master Spira talking about fear of death and death itself. So we've come to the end of another program. That, incidentally, was Charles who rang in from Monterey. He wanted to know the spelling of Muji, Master Muji. And I told him that you can, all these teachers that we had, that we talked about, you'll find them on YouTube if you want to, you know, on your own, in your own time. If you want to learn more from these people, they're available. And also, the site on the internet called Buddha at the Gas Pump is an excellent site for people who are very interested in spiritual insight. And so you can go there. Rick Archer is the man who runs that site, and it's well known, and it's an excellent site for those people who are interested in spiritual insights. And also, all these programs that I'm doing here on the radio can be accessed in the archives. And where you go for that is you go to Radio for All. The four is the letter four, so it's radioforall.net. Radio for All is all one word, .net. And then when you open that site, you go to the search part. There's a little window on the right. And in the search part there, you put in the name of the show, which is Health and the Awakening of the Self. And all the programs that I put on there, maybe 12 or 13 programs, will come up. And you can click on those, and they'll open for you, and you can listen to them anytime you have time or you're free. All right, it was great being with you again. And the next program, this one was 2 hours together we had. The next one will be 1 hour. So I look forward to seeing you on the next program of Health and the Awakening of the Self. Good night.
Wednesday, December 17th, in front of the Harris County Courthouse, Houston, Texas.
No more drug war!